Streaming 24/7, on-demand archives, podcasts, and more.
TalkZone.com.
TalkZone.com. Saying a lot for planet Earth. Now, the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com. Internet Talk Radio. Here's your host, Dave Baum.
Hey, welcome back. Welcome in to the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com. Great to have you aboard again. Across the world, 59 countries, 1,600 plus cities, and we appreciate it. Purpose of this show, frankly, is to talk about compelling issues, current issues, inside the issues, the who, what, where, why, when, and how. And we've got a great double bill for you on today's show. The immigration debacle. Round one. Round two, we'll talk about, and you put them in the order that you think it's appropriate, kids, parents, sex, school. Or is it sex, kids, parents, school? At any rate, we'll talk about that later. So as you can see, always fun, always interesting on this show. Invite you to be a listener or a caller at 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888-463-6748. 463-6748. It's a toll-free call. Simply stated, if you need something to remember it by, it's 888 go for it. How long has it been possible, and how has it been possible, for this nation's immigration policies and strategies to get as fouled up as they are today? Step back for a moment and take a look at the immigration policies of this country. Frankly, it didn't take all that long. And what seemingly made sense years ago, remember we had quotas? If you were from a certain country in a certain part of the world, X number of you came in. That's the way it used to be. It used to be the quota system. Well, that's dissipated into a political groveling of the highest order. It's become totally political. Which party can pander most to the leaders of the mostly legal and illegal immigrants in the United States? And now it's become so insipid that some lawmakers wish to propose to provide driver's licenses for illegals. You recall that story recently in which the governor of New York said, well, perhaps we need legislation to give illegal immigrants driver's licenses, and a presidential candidate couldn't decide which side of her mouth she wanted to talk out of. And then eventually, when the pressure got so hot, the governor of New York decided to back off. And so the presidential candidate was able to take a deep breath and didn't have to worry about what she said and how she said it. Well, the problem is there is no solution or apparent solution that either party can come up with. My guest on the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com is Stephen Malanga, co-author of The Immigration Solution, A Better Plan Than Today's. Stephen, welcome to the Dave Baum Show on TalkZone.com.
Well, thanks for having me.
Nice to have you with us today. Most older Americans, Stephen, like me, remember the quota system and wonder what happened to that and what followed. Can you bring us up to date?
Absolutely. And in fact, what happened to that is very relevant to why we have a mess today. The quota system was ended and actually changed in the mid-1960s. And what happened is, in the middle of the civil rights movement, people began in this country discussing the quota system and decided that it was discriminatory because the quotas were by national origins. And frankly, the quotas had been put in place in the 1920s with the idea
that kind of favored whites in Western Europe, didn't they?
Not only whites, but actually Anglo-Saxon whites from Northern Europe. Absolutely right. So the idea was, we have to change this particular system. But the change was not debated in terms of what's good for the American economy, what kind of immigrants do we need, what kind of immigrants might succeed here. Instead, the change was debated as part of the civil rights movement, the humanitarian movement. And the idea was, we went to actually much broader hemispheric quotas, which could more easily be filled, because what happened under the old quota system is, if a certain country didn't fill its quota because people didn't want to come here, well, then it just didn't get filled. What happened under the new system with these much broader hemispheric quotas is that the one country didn't fill its quota, people from other countries who wanted to come here could fill that quota. And so quickly, within 10 years, our legal immigration increased by 60%.
So let's see if I'm with you so far. Let's take Central America. If one country in Central America didn't fill its quota, another country in Central America could take the difference and use it.
Exactly, because we weren't even going by countries. We were going by these very broad sort of hemispheric. Right. So the first thing that happened is that legal immigration increased very quickly. By 60% in 10 years, as I say. Now, that was totally unanticipated by, or at least, well, if we can judge the sponsors of this legislation, including Senator Ed Kennedy, by what they said, this was totally unanticipated. Kennedy said flat out, and I actually quote him in the book saying this in the mid-60s, you know, this legislation will not seriously increase our legal immigration. You know, it'll merely make it more humane.
I saw that in your book, and I wondered, because I was a reasonably thinking adult at that time, what was he thinking?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that what most people, and I don't know whether he had, you know, duplicitous ideas in mind at that particular point, but I know that people who actually believed that this system wouldn't increase immigration, what they were doing is they were looking at the fact that in post-war Europe, people were not as interested in coming here because they were doing well. And they figured, well, you know, we're not going to fill our immigration quotas. We haven't been filling them. We shouldn't worry. It never seemed to occur to people that if we allowed those immigration slots to be switched to places like South America, Central America, Asia, that in fact there would be lots of people there who were much poorer and who weren't doing as well, certainly in the 1960s especially, who would want to come here. They simply never thought that that would actually be the case.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it, Stephen, because hindsight is 2020, but the thinking 40-some years ago that if there's dwindling interest from Anglo-Saxons in Western Europe to come to the United States, or whites from Western Europe, then frankly, we would never see an increase in people who wanted to come here from other parts of the world.
Right. It seems naive in retrospect, doesn't it? Now, let me add one thing, that what also complicated the situation is that in addition to doing this with the quotas, what they also did is they put in this family preferences idea. And with the family preferences idea, you know, it went well beyond just, if I'm allowed to come here, I can bring my spouse and my children. In fact, the family preferences extended to, let's say, the adult brothers and sisters of people who are already here, and in addition, their adult parents. And so this created this really long chain. It was like, if I'm here and I could bring my adult brother over, once my adult brother came, he was allowed to bring his wife and their children. Once his wife got here, she, of course, could bring her adult siblings, and on and on and on. So if, you know, you subscribe to the notion of 6 degrees of separation, or even just 2 or 3 degrees of separation, what happened is within 10 or 15 years, we had this really long backlog of people wanting to come here because of family preferences. And over the years, we've kept increasing the number of legal slots for family preferences, because the backlog is so big that politicians say, this is a crime that we have such a big backlog. It's a crime that all these people are waiting so long. We have to let more in. And, of course, every time you let more in under the family preferences rule, what happens? Of course, more and more people around the world become eligible to come by virtue of the same notion of family preferences. So that sort of created the part of the reason why we have this mess, even with legal immigration.
Well, I want to ask you what the difference in how you define family preferences after this change of philosophy was between what happened at the end of World War II in the mid to late 40s and early 50s, when a lot of people over here who were living here, citizens, used family preferences, the same concept, to bring their sisters, brothers, aunts, uncles, children, mothers, and fathers from war-torn Europe. Wasn't that the same concept?
It was the same concept. It was somewhat more limited. Many of those people who came from war-torn Europe actually came under the refugee provisions of our immigration law, which is completely different from our legal immigration. You were talking about people who were coming from places who could make a case that they had a refugee status, and this is a whole long involved discussion.
Well, that's why I asked you, because I can recall my father served as a, I think the word was sponsor.
Yes.
Served as a sponsor for some of his family to come to the United States, after World War II.
Even in those cases, okay, even in those cases, the person coming had to fall under the national quota system at the time.
Ah.
Although your father wanted to sponsor this particular person, if the quota was already filled for that particular country, he'd have to get in line and wait for year after year. What happened with the changes in the mid-1960s is as the family preferences list got longer and longer and longer, we kept expanding it, not expanding it, but expanding the number of visas for family preferences, so that by the time you get to today, we've had several expansions, and our total legal immigration to the United States, our total legal immigration is now 1 million people a year. That's enormous, far beyond what any other country in the world allows. And so, you know, when you hear people talk about how America is turning restrictionist because we want to stop illegals from coming here, it's of course absurd. We still have the largest legal immigration system by far of any country in the world.
And I would suggest, and help me out if I'm off base here, that as the influx grew larger because the system allowed more to come here, the immigration department, as it were, did not grow exponentially as large. Well, I mean, we're seeing that today, aren't we? With almost every government department, and we're finding out that there's 200 inspectors to watch over all the pharmaceuticals. Consumer products can't keep up with painted dolls from China because they've only got 50 people to cover the United States. I would assume the same is true here for the immigration department and those who would watch it closely?
Well, it's been true for many years, and this is part of the root of the problem. As you probably know, reform legislation in the late 1980s granted amnesty to illegals who were already here. About 2.7 million illegals qualified under that amnesty. That turned out to be an absolute disaster because INS could not keep up with the applications, and in particular what happened is they couldn't investigate fraud.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, if I can just interrupt here with a thought. A lot of people, including myself, have wondered for over 20 years, has the problem just become too tough to solve rationally? Is that why they're looking for all of these Band-Aid solutions to whoever is in, even though they got in illegally, can stay in because it would be too tough, or a lot of people would be very upset if we put them on a bus or a plane and sent them back where they came from because they're illegal?
No, it hasn't become too tough to solve. The problem with the solution that I just outlined for you, meaning the amnesty solution, is it involved direct government intervention in a very bureaucratic way, and that is very, very difficult. However, one of the things we know this from past experience, including after 9/11, and we know it from what's going on now, is we do know that enforcement of our laws works to force people to remigrate. Now, I make a point in the book, I spend a lot of time talking about what's known as the First Great Migration, which took place from about 1880 to 1925. What people don't realize is that the majority of people who came during that migration didn't stay. They went home. They went home if they couldn't make it here in America. They went home because we didn't have social welfare programs.
Really?
Yes, yes. More than 50% went home. There have been studies of some specific ethnic groups. Among Italians, for instance, rather, it's estimated that 65% of all immigrants went back. So when we talk of ourselves as a nation of immigrants, what we really mean, it sounds obvious, but we're really a nation of the immigrants who stayed.
Isn't that interesting? Because the perception today would be that all the Europeans who came here in the late 1800s, early to mid-1900s, most of them stayed here because the streets were paved with gold.
And that's another, that's another.
Haven't heard that one in a long time, have you, that the streets were paved with gold?
And if you believe that's true, of course, just stop for a minute and think about something called the Depression, okay? The Depression actually turned the United States into a net out-migration country. What I mean by that is that during the Depression, more people actually left the United States to go live somewhere else, including people who were remigrating, than came into the United States. So economic cycles actually influence immigration highly. But anyway, the reason this is all relevant is because part of the problem that we have today is that we've not been enforcing our laws. And in addition to that, we've been providing government benefits to people who aren't qualified for them, who don't qualify for them because they're not citizens. So part of what we urge, because we've seen this work before, is we need to begin enforcing laws, for instance, our employment laws. We've had a system that we've been discussing for more than 20 years now, requiring employers to check social security numbers in the national database, requiring employers to make sure that people are, to the best of their ability, legal. These kinds of laws haven't been enforced.
Why?
Well, for political reasons, because there's been a lot of every group from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce on one hand to immigrant advocacy groups on the other hand have resisted these, and as a result of that, even when these kinds of programs have been written into laws, as they were during the 1980s. The amnesty that was proposed in the 1980s was part of a trade-off, which was supposed with conservative groups who said, well, we also want tougher employer sanctions. That the employer sanctions were written into the bill, and they were never enforced.
Well, interestingly enough, isn't it true that most recently the Bush administration suspended its legal defense of a new rule issued this past summer to punish employers who hire illegal immigrants?
Absolutely. This has been, again, a long-term problem. However, it's also true that after the failure of the comprehensive immigration reform this summer, the Bush administration, under a tremendous amount of pressure, has now started actually enforcing certain laws. And we're already starting to see remigration. We saw this even after 9/11. After 9/11 in New York City, the FBI and federal immigration authorities began deporting Pakistanis who were here illegally in New York City because they were extremely worried about that. What ultimately happened is we estimate somewhere between 3 and 4 times as many Pakistanis who were here illegally went back of their own will once the government started deporting people.
Back to Pakistan.
Exactly. Because they were afraid of being in the government sites.
Mm-hmm.
The New York Times just ran a story yesterday, surprisingly enough, about the very large Brazilian population in the greater metropolitan area that is now starting to go back to Brazil. They interviewed any number of people who make the point that they've been here for maybe a decade waiting for legalization, and after the failure of the legalization law this summer, people have now begun to realize that they're not going to be legalized, and so they're starting to go back. Another big impact.
But my question, based upon what you just said, is for so many illegals, why does it make any difference?
Well, it's starting to make a difference now because we're enforcing our laws.
Ah.
For instance, one of the things that's really prompting people to start going back is that states for years have been giving driver's licenses. You know, they have not specifically been giving them to illegals. They just haven't been checking. In the wake of 9/11, and under a lot of pressure, most states have gotten a lot tougher. A good example is Florida. Florida has an 8-year driver's license, and many illegals apparently had driver's license in Florida. Many of those licenses are now starting to expire, and illegals cannot get renewals. They won't be able to drive in Florida. That is prompting remigration of illegals who are in Florida. Now, the problem is if only some states do this, and if other states like New York give licenses, no questions asked.
Mm-hmm.
Then what you do is you just move people from one state to another. You create that kind of incentive. That's one of the reasons why it is important not to have some states creating those kinds of incentives.
What kind of a message did the New York debacle send to other states and the federal government?
Well, I think I think the states are all over the map in terms of their philosophy. Some states are at this very moment, and I would say from the spring and certainly from the summer onward, they've been putting in place very tough new state laws. We've seen tough laws in Georgia,
mm-hmm.
Oklahoma, Nebraska. These are states that are suddenly seeing a sharp increase in their illegal population as immigrants move beyond the traditional states of California, New York, and the border states. So some states are really getting tougher. Other states politically are so liberal or so you know, so sort of, or where ethnic interests, immigrant interests are so powerful, like New York, that they're trying to resist this. But the outcry is has been so great that I think that rather than New York sending a message to the rest of the country, the rest of the country sent a message to New York.
A fascinating beginning to our conversation with Stephen Malunga, co-author of The Immigration Solution, A Better Plan Than Today's. And frankly, folks, today's doesn't work. Hasn't worked for a long time. If you want in on our conversation as a caller, our number is 1-888-463-6748. That's 1-888-463-6748. As we go to break, let me give you something to chew on that we'll pick up on with Stephen when we return. The difference between low skill and high skill, and how it applies to this immigration mess.